In the Royal Service of Radio Moscow, you're listening to a program of classical music. Developments took a different course. The tendency to dismember the country prevailed, which I cannot accept. And following the Alma-Ata meeting and the decisions taken there, my position has not changed. Besides this, I am convinced that decisions of this scope should have been taken on the basis of a popular referendum. Nevertheless, I will do everything in my powers to help the agreement signed there to result in genuine harmony in society and to facilitate our emergence from the crisis and the reform process. Speaking before you for the last time as the President of the USSR, I consider it possible to assess the road covered since 1985, the more so since there are quite a few contradictory and superficial and subjective he was on the score. Fate has resolved that at the moment when I came to the head of the state, it became clear that the country was in a troubled state. There was plenty of everything, land, oil, gas, other mineral wealth, and plenty of intellect and wisdom, and yet we are far worse off than the developed countries and are falling behind them. The reason for this was obvious. Society was strangled by the command and administer system, doomed to service and ideology, and carry a terrible arms burden. It was straining its efforts to the limit. All attempts at partial reforms, there had been plenty of them, had failed one after another. The country was losing its perspective. It was impossible to go on living that way. It was necessary to change everything in a cardinal manner. That was why I did not once feel sorry that I had used the role of General Secretary to reign for several years. I would have considered this immoral and irresponsible. I realized that beginning reforms of this scale in such a society as ours was a most difficult and risky undertaking. But today, too, I remain convinced that it was correct historically to undertake the democratic reforms that were undertaken in the spring of 1985. The process of rejuvenation in the country, of radical reforms in the world community, was far more difficult than expected. And what has been done must be assessed properly. Society has received freedom. It has been emancipated spiritually and economically, and this is the most important gain which we have not yet fully come to appreciate, because we have not yet learned to make use of freedom. Nonetheless, the work accomplished is of historic significance. We have abolished the totalitarian system, which deprived the country of becoming prosperous. A breakthrough has been effected in democratic change. Free elections have become a reality. Freedom of the press, religious freedom, representative bodies of power, a multi-power society, the rights of the individual, human rights, have become a supreme principle. Movement has begun towards a multi-sectoral economy. The equality of all forms of property is being asserted. A land reform is beginning to revive the peasantry. Farmers have arisen. Millions of acres of land are being turned over to rural and urban dwellers. The producer has gained economic freedom, and entrepreneurship, shareholding, are gaining momentum. Privatization, too, in turning towards the market. It must be remembered that all this is being done for the human good. In this difficult period, everything must be done for the social protection of the people, and this applies particularly to the aged and the children. We are living in a new world. We have done away with the Cold War, stopped the arms race, and the insane militarization of the country, which deformed our economy and social thinking and morals. The threat of a world war has been removed. And once again, I want to underline that in the transition period, I have done everything I could to maintain effective control of nuclear weapons. We are now open to the world. We have rejected interference in the affairs of others, using forces abroad. And this has won solidarity and respect. We have become one of the bulwarks of the remaking of contemporary civilization along civilized lines. The nations now have a genuine freedom of choice and self-determination. The search for social reforms, democratic reforms in our multinational state had led us to forming a new Church of the Union. These changes required enormous efforts. They took place in a difficult struggle with mounting resistance by the forces of the old moribund and reactionary. The old party and government structures, the economic machinery, and our ideological prejudices, our egalitarian psychology, encounter our intolerance, low standards of political culture, and fear of change. That is why we lost so much time. The old system has collapsed, and it collapsed before the new system became operational, and the crisis of society became even more acute. I know of the discontent among people over the present difficulties, of the acute criticism of authority at all levels, and of criticism of my personal activities. But I want to underscore once again that cardinal changes in so vast a country with such a heritage cannot be painless. They cannot proceed without difficulties and upheavals. The August coup brought the crisis to the breaking point. The most disastrous element in that crisis was the disintegration of statehood. And today, I'm concerned most of all by the fact that our citizens have lost their citizenship in a great power. The consequences may be very grave for all. It is vitally important, in my view, to retain the democratic gains of the past few years. They have been won in struggle with our tragic historical experience. They cannot be given up in any circumstances and under any pretext. Otherwise, all hope for a better future will be buried. All this is something I speak about honestly and bluntly. I feel this to be my moral duty. Today, I want to express my appreciation to all the citizens who supported the policy of reviving the country, who joined in carrying out democratic reform. I am grateful to the statesmen, political and public leaders, to the millions of people abroad, to all those who understood our aspirations and responded with sincere cooperation. I'm leaving my post with a sense of anxiety and also hope, with faith in your strength of spirit. We are the heirs to a great civilization, and upon us depends that it be revived. To revive your life. From the bottom of my heart, I wish to thank all those who, all these years with me, supported this noble cause. I'm sure some mistakes could have been avoided, much could have been done better, but I'm convinced that sooner or later, our common efforts will bear fruit. Our people will live a thriving and prosperous life in a democratic society. I wish you all the best. Mikhail Gorbachev has just concluded his resignation speech as president of the USSR.
That was a live broadcast of President Mikhail Gorbachev's resignation address. You are tuned to Radio Moscow World News.
In the World Service of Radio Moscow, we invite you to listen to a program featuring music by Sergei Rachmaninov. A reminder that here tune to Radio Moscow World Service. Service of Radio Moscow, you're listening to me, that's by Sergei Rachmaninov. Thank you.
Mikhail Gorbachev has declared his resignation on national television. President Boris Yeltsin of Russia has taken over control of the nuclear arms of the dissolved USSR. As soon as President Mikhail Gorbachev declared his resignation, the nuclear launch codes were placed in Boris Yeltsin's hands. The leaders of the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf have called for extending sanctions against Iraq and ruled out any contacts with it until it complied with the United Nations resolutions. A statement to that effect is contained in a special communique following a summit conference of the Cooperation Council of the Arab States of the Gulf in Kuwait. An official representative of the President of Georgia in London has announced that his republic, where a civil war has broken out, intends to join the Commonwealth of Independent States. Meanwhile, fighting continues in Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. According to latest reports, over 50 persons have been killed and 176 others injured in the fighting between the supporters and opponents of the Georgian president. That was News in Chief. You can hear a full bulletin of news on the hour.
Radio Moscow World Service presents its daily feature, Africa as we see it. In today's edition, our observer comments on the aggravated situation in Togo, a talk on reorganizing state services in African countries, assessments of the results of the Convention for a Democratic South Africa, this and more in today's issue of Africa as we see it. The domestic political situation has worsened again in Togo. Comments by Vladimir Voivodov. The Republic of Togo has just had time to recover from a military mutiny undertaken 3 weeks ago. But on Monday, the army made another reminder that it still exists. A group of soldiers entered the radio and television building in Lome and forced journalists to read over the air the text of a communique prepared by the military. The communique contained a demand that the Supreme Council of the Republic be dissolved, and that is the legislative body elected for the interim period at a national conference last September. The communique pointed out that this body had been formed out of pseudo-democrats. It offered to set up a new parliament, more balanced ethnically, which would reflect the interests of various tribes inhabiting Togo. Observers know that the inter-ethnic differences have already led to clashes in that country, some of them taking place in the Togolese capital last October. And yet, apparently, it's not the tribal differences that form the basis of the current conflict.
They are only a reflection of the struggle for power between supporters of the former regime and of the new state structures created by the decisions of the National Conference this past autumn. Its significance for carrying out democratic reforms in Togo is doubtless, since the conference started a transition from authoritarian power to a multi-party democracy. At the same time, both the supporters and the opponents of the transformations now underway note that the conference decisions were not faultless in every respect, just as the decisions of the new bodies of power the conference set up. A spokesman for the army leadership, who had a meeting with the Prime Minister Kofi Go and with the chairman of the Supreme Council of the Republic, Fanoko Kpodziro, voiced their dissatisfaction to the latter over the methods of leadership displayed back during his chairmanship of the National Conference. The head of the personal staff of President Eyadema, General Yao Amei, underlined that the process of democratization in Togo had taken a bad start. And finally, Prime Minister Kofi Go admitted even earlier that the conference had failed in its main task of achieving national reconciliation. Apparently, this exactly is the main reason for the current instability in the country. The French news agency quoted a Lomé resident saying, "We no longer know who rules us, who takes decisions, and when we have a government." And there is indeed no government in Togo so far. After it was actually dissolved as a result of the mutiny on the 3rd of December, Prime Minister Kofi Go repeatedly declared it was to be formed shortly. The last time he made a promise to form it before the new year. However, after the meeting with the military on Tuesday, in the presence of President Eyadema, it was announced that the composition of the new interim government will be known only after the new year. Observers don't rule it out that the continued uncertainty of the political situation, with an obvious pressure by the military, can lead the new tests of strength by the confronting sides. Vladimir Voyvodov on the situation in Togo.
This is Radio Moscow with Africa as we see it. In his commentary, Vladimir Mikhailov discusses reorganization of state services in the countries of Africa. In the past months, Africa was the venue for many conferences and seminars. News media obviously found it difficult to highlight all the events. This appears to be the reason why African press did not give prominence to the Conference on African State Services that was held in Benin's economic center, Cotonou. The conference discussed a topical problem, democratization of a country's political life, a reform of the administrative system that requires reconsidering of state functions and an orientation to a free market economy. All these presuppose a radical restructuring of state governing bodies. Speakers at the conference used concrete materials and experience of such countries as Senegal, Cameroon, and Benin. Practice has shown that in the absence of a radical restructuring of state apparatus, there can be no economic progress or democratization of a society's social and political life. Restructuring is no easy matter. In the years of independent development, state apparatus has become a powerful force in the countries of Africa. It's incredibly large. Till the present military administration came to power in Nigeria in 1985, the country spent one-third of its budget to feed state officials. That doesn't include expenditure on keeping the army. Everybody agrees that the staff of state agencies should be reduced, but as Benin's experience has shown, this is a very painful process. Redundancy plans announced by the Benin government in 1984 caused protests of the trade unions and a wave of strikes. As a result, the Benin government is now drafting a program of alternative employment for 10,000 officials it planned to dismiss. Certainly, criteria of employment are also extremely important.
In most countries of the continent, governing bodies were staffed on the tribal principles of loyalty to one party. The result was corruption and incompetence of state officials. In the Republic of Congo, investigation was recently undertaken into the case of embezzlement of state property to the tune of 30 million African francs by officials who belonged in no distant past to the ruling Congolese Labor Party. A multi-party system gives more opportunity to supervise the activity of state officials and less chance for embezzlement. This was the point of many speakers at the conference, who underlined that the administrative reform in the countries of Africa should be closely linked with democratization of social and political life. Otherwise, African countries can again get bogged down by the administrative bureaucratic structures that have a tendency to quickly revive and spread out. Commentary was by Vladlen Mikhailov.
Radio Moscow with Africa as we see it. The closing convention for a democratic Africa continues to draw comment in South Africa. Our commentator looks at the situation in the country. The representatives of the government, the African National Congress of South Africa, and 17 other political organizations have adopted a declaration of intentions, which is practically a program for transition from the system of apartheid to democracy. 5 working groups have been formed at the forum that will offer practical recommendations on various aspects of the program. The first meetings of the groups will be held on the 20th of next month. Most observers call the results of the convention historic because, if realized, the latest accords will promote the creation of a free and democratic South Africa. It's clear that to start acting on the accords would be no easy matter. The white rightist extremists declared they would launch a civil war if the sides started to act on their decisions adopted by the convention. In this context, the African National Congress doesn't wish to completely disarm its military wing, Umkhonto we Sizwe, the more so since the leaders of its main rival, the Inkatha Freedom Party, didn't sign the declaration. Surprisingly, former irreconcilable enemies have united in their opposition to the convention's decisions. The results of the forum are severely criticized by both the white rightist extremists and the black radicals. The leader of the conservative party, Andreas Treurnicht, who is for preserving apartheid in South Africa, declared that the convention was an attempt to transfer power to the African National Congress. In turn, the statement of the Pan-African Congress that boycotted the convention alleges that the adopted documents strengthened the regime of the white dominance in South Africa. It looks like the natural turn of events has frightened the critics of the declaration, and they now try to mislead the others in order to realize their political ambitions in the struggle for power. Not only do they threaten with a civil war, they also plan assassinations of South African political leaders, including President Frederick de Klerk and ANC Chairman Nelson Mandela. A police official in his interview to the newspaper Citizen said that they feared someone would trigger this monstrous plan.